You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. One of Us is a podcast and video network funded all but entirely by donations and subscriptions. We do accept pitches for audio-based or banner ads, but on a case-by-case basis. If you're interested in that, contact us at oneofusnet@gmail.com. With the amount of audio and video content we generate, it is expensive and extremely time-consuming to keep things running. Please go to the webpage oneofus.net and sign up for a subscription at $2, $5, $10, or $25 and get a ton of bonus content. One of Us needs and appreciates all your support. This movie review also comes for subscribers at Time Lord level or above, an uncut, unedited, longer video version of the review. Become a subscriber and check it out. Well, I admit I'm the guy who was saying for years now, please, Paramount, stop doing prequel shit. Stop showing us shit that happened in the niches in between shit. I think the furthest forward we had seen in the timeline is Nemesis.
Well, technically Spock traveling back in 2009, but that's just a glimpse.
The
just a
little glimpse, tiny yeah. bit in the beginning of J.J.
And if you read the comic, you would know that Geordi LaForge designed the ship that he...
As you can tell, some of us might be Star Trek nerds. Some of us might not be. I'm actually not entirely clear where all of us fall on this, except for TC, who obviously is a huge Star Trek nerd.
I have it on good authority that we've all had sex at least once. So we're not that bad.
So it's just recently that we're finally getting to see what did in fact happen post-Nemesis, post that little beginning of the J.J. Abrams movie, which first with Picard, which had a little bit more immediately post, and then Lower Decks, which is in 2280, which is 1 year after Nemesis, 5 years before the earliest flashback in Star Trek Picard, and now we get way, way, way in the future, post, finally, which is weird because this show started out set in the first two seasons in one of the earliest bits of the Star Trek timeline.
10 years before Kirk.
So I was like, fucking A. When the end of the last season, they went, we are going into the future, and not just like 3 weeks after the events of what we saw before, but we're going far into the future.
937 years.
Only going where no showrunner has ever gone before.
I would argue that's too many. I think 100 would have done it, but continue.
I'm excited. I'm like, yeah, I get to see what all my old friends are up to, what all these races are, what's going on. And has anyone seen or will at least give me some reference as to where the fucking Klingons are?
No, you do not get anything. For considering how critical the freaking Klingon War was at the beginning of things, for them to not even say, hey, what happened to our ridged-headed friends? Anyone?
1,000 years from the future, they look like they do in the original series now. They're completely unidentifiable. They're just swarthy men with wispy mustaches.
We did see them. We didn't realize because now they all look like furniture. That's their new thing. They just look like couches.
Well, to me, Klingons are like Daleks. I don't really want to see them anymore.
Not me. Klingons are an essential part of the Star Trek universe and one of the most interesting aspects. But
Concur. There's
a lot of stuff that I really like about Star Trek Discovery Season 3, and there's a lot of stuff I really didn't like about Star Trek Discovery Season 3. And we're going to get into all that in just a moment with our review featuring Marco.
Hello.
TC.
Hello, sir.
And Doggett.
Star Doggett.
When we ended the last season, we saw Michael Burnham, who is the main character of the show, sent all the way into the future in the year 3188, finds out that, shit, the Discovery is not here. And even worse, the United Federation of Planets doesn't appear to be here either, or Starfleet. There's something called the Burn had happened that made most of the galaxy's dilithium just blow up. So anything that had a switched on warp drive just went... which is the majority of the starships in the universe, people can't travel super far, or rather, they can use warp, but only very, very, very rarely because there's so little dilithium left. It is the most valuable thing there is in the universe. And there is, of course, also a group of toxic capitalists who are enslaving people. And ironically, the leaders of it appear to be Orions, who, when we previously knew them, were a slave race. But I guess it's sort of like the abused kid growing up to be an abuser. her, if you will. But she right off the bat finds herself making connections in this world, especially with a character named Booker.
Fantastic space beasts, and where does space find them?
He's got the Han Solo, the Maul from Firefly thing going on. He's kind of a badass, but, you know, surprisingly, we get to know him. We're like, oh, well, even though you're kind of a smuggler, you're like one of those good smugglers.
Michael Ayla, he played Manchester Black on Supergirl, if anyone follows that series. He's actually a very compelling actor.
That's where I knew him from. God,
as soon as he appeared, I was like, ooh, Manchester.
Name something else, please.
He's in Star Trek Discovery Season 3. This first episode is an excellent repilot because we are almost 1,000 years beyond where we were before. You could literally jump on the show here with very little need to know what came before. It's an entirely whole new universe.
They have to set up the new rules. They have to say, well, this is the state of the universe. What happened to all these different races and why are they doing the things they're doing now? For instance, like fulfilling the Spock legacy, the Romulans and the Vulcans reunited. They are one again, and they've renamed Vulcan even in honor of it to, what is it, Nivar, I believe it was.
Yeah, just Nimoy getting to be on the screen for that brief moment.
And they have the coolest named ships, Razors. I was like, yes, please. I will take a model of one of those. They, like a lot of other people, are very sort of like, yeah, everybody kind of left the Federation because it didn't really, the Starfleet, because it didn't really serve much purpose in a time when no one can come out and help people. So once Discovery eventually shows up, everything is kind of about, where is Starfleet? Something has to be left of it, which of course there is. It's just kind of ineffective. What was the burn and how do we keep it from ever happening again? And that's sort of the goal here. And then the interesting thing as well, I like that Saru, played by the great Doug Jones, is captain of the ship and gets a chance to shine. But
brilliantly so. Best character on the show for my money.
He's such a good actor. He really is. Anybody who can act through that much latex is really good at what they do.
Yeah.
A lot of new characters were introduced this season. A lot of new elements are introduced. From this point on, this review is a spoiler review for the season. So
this show starts off doing one of the best things I've ever seen in any Star Trek media. They jump into the future. Like Chris said, they finally leave the old timeline. They no longer have to worry about constantly dancing around continuity issues. They can just be their own thing, which is why it's so disappointing that as much as I enjoyed most of this season, it still suffers from the same problem the past two seasons did. They've got an hour-long format with a generous amount of episodes, a total of 15 episodes per season, plenty of time to tell a complex, nuanced story, and yet Discovery always feels like they're just trying to cram everything in the last 10 minutes.
Yes.
It's too many characters, too many subplots. Either give them more episodes and allow the story to breathe, or trim some of the fat out.
This is one of the only shows that I kind of wish would go back to the 22, 23 episodes a season model, where they would have time to do the more Planet of the Week episodes to give you a little more time to breathe between the big plot elements. It just wants to crunch so much shit happening in. It's like, hey, Alex Kurtzman, you know this isn't a movie, right? This is a whole season of a show.
Mm-hmm. It's trying to be the 15-hour movie, and it can't really do that in a serialized format. And, you know, it's a shame because this is the first Star Trek show in a while that actually loves the Federation and Starfleet. Mm-hmm. It's almost corny. I didn't realize how much I needed that optimism.
Yeah.
Where they wake up in a universe where it's like, Starfleet's pretty much dead. Everyone thinks you're all a bunch of corny motherfuckers and dismisses you all as like the true believers. And yet Discovery and Burnham are like, no, the Federation was great. Starfleet was great. We need it again in the universe. And they had a great A-plot, the mystery of the burn.
They had to, like, get Starfleet back on track. Like, you have to get a cat out who snuck under a bed, right? You're just like, come on, come on.
Oh, it's dangerous out there. We don't want to go exploring.
One of the biggest problems I have against this show, it's not the Orville. Unfortunately, nothing can change that. But I really like the person with the short hair.
Deera, she is a person who they meet. She was part of the Earth Force.
They are part of the Earth Force.
We have to assign non-binary.
Sorry, they are. Played by Blue Del Barrio, who is in fact non-gender as well. And they have a boyfriend named Gray Tal, played by Ian Alexander, who is a Trill. But shit happens. Said Trill ends up inside of Adira instead. This is not unheard of, a human having a Trill in them, because Riker had one for a while, which was awkward and kind of squeaky in that particular episode. But in this case, Deera is the first one to keep a Trill, and that is a whole thing. Gray ends up basically dying, but you know, like, if you're a Trill, you have all the memories of everybody who's ever had the symbiote in you, but something's weird with because of the way that happens, and now Gray is more of a sort of, like, appearing to her like a helpful ghost, like, that even sentient, other people can see later at one point.
They do seem to hint that they're going to continue going forward with that, which would be nice because God knows they drop enough plot lines.
Well, there was an insinuation that Hollow Technology could recognize its consciousness and act on it and make Gray more concrete. So I presume they're going to use the Doctor technology from Voyager at some point and say, okay, so we can make a solid hologram out.
Plus, they now have this great thing called smart matter. What do they call it? Which is a really cool concept. That's the other great thing about jumping into the future. Like, yeah, we got teleporters, but now they're personal size. You know, anybody can teleport anywhere, anytime. The ships are like magnetically held together, but they can reconfigure in flight. That's cool as fuck.
Dude, his ship morphs. Like, it's like going through like asteroid fields. It's like changing shape and moving around. I was like, dude, I can't wait till they do that to the Discovery, which presumably they will. I thought it was a little weird the way they took Anthony Rapp and Wilson Cruz's character, Stamets and Culber, and had them sort of, without anybody even saying anything, just kind of adopt Adira.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, well, you're gay and we're gay, so, you know, we should hang out together, I guess. And I was like, that was weird. And the sequence where they have to explain pronouns to Anthony Rapp, it just felt so like, really? This far in the future?
Exactly. I thought the exact same thing. It should be a complete non-issue. It's a 2021 issue to have that conversation. So I understand why it's there. But you can have that conversation with nuance. They did it 20 years ago in frickin' TNG with the Riker episode, which you'd mentioned Riker with the Trill. There's an episode where Riker falls in love with a non-binary alien who assigns a female pronoun to herself. And they had that intellectual conversation then with more nuance than they did hammering it over the head now, which is the freaking MO of this show. It's an out of place moment.
I'm pretty sure there are members of the Discovery that have like 23 genders or something. You know, they're like, oh, this is Bill from the planet Iklak. You know, he's actually got 23 genders. Today he's a girl, but tomorrow he might be your grandmother. We don't know. It's a really weird race. They do things differently. Sometimes he just gives birth right in the middle of battles. It's kind of awkward, but he's really manly when you need him to be.
I agree with you, Doggett. I really liked Adira. They ended up being an excellent addition to the cast. Plus, she has that quality, the Wesley Crusher, but not annoying. And I kind of like the child genius character in this setting where I'm like, they're a prodigy engineer that humorously makes Stamets uncomfortable because of their gift.
They have 100 years of information inside of themselves. And so you're right. It's Wesley without being obnoxious.
The other great thing about this is it's a really good hook for a show. You have the Discovery. They're this ancient ship now. They're 1,000 years old, but they show up at a time when dilithium is at a premium. They have this weird experimental spore drive, which I admit, after season 2, I stopped trying to understand how it works. Just say magic mushrooms. They're magic mushrooms that power your vessel.
I mean, it makes sense now that they're like, oh, well, it turns out the whole time you just had to care about people so much that it became an ability to fly it.
Bunch of goddamn hippies over here.
They've got all of the AI sentient data from season 2, I think. Dow is on the ship. They have all of this knowledge and a technological edge that no one else in the galaxy has. That's really cool. I wish they would have explored that more rather than, since we're talking about spoilers, finally we do get the mystery of the burn solved, and it just conveniently wraps up with, oh shit, look, a planet of dilithium. Problem solved. It's like, no, this was more interesting to me. Like, how does the universe function when, you know, these resources are so scarce? And likewise with the Emerald Chain, it's like the idea of maybe an uneasy alliance, a back and forth type of truce situation would have been compelling. But by the final episode, they're like, nah, we're not going to do that. It's really frustrating.
Star Trek has always had an issue with defining exactly how it feels about monetary issues. Like, Kirk won't even pay for a pizza and beer in Star Trek The Voyage Home. Like, it's like, what, you're going to tell me they don't have money in the future? We don't. Which is a great line. But obviously, to some extent, they do, because they've dealt with the Ferengi and Laudanum and all sorts of other stuff along the way. Osira, the Orion main villain, clearly is, this, like I said, this representation of toxic capitalism. And I did like the idea, like you said, of like, oh, there is a way to keep this going on in the show. But by the end, they're just just like, oh, and we defeated them. And the Star Trek is back to being no money. I'm like, that's not.
And can we talk about how stupid Osira's plan is? She's set up as the big bad all season long. Okay, your plan is steal the Discovery, hijack it, take the crew hostage, use the ship as a Trojan horse to get past Starfleet security. Once you're inside their base, then use the hostages as leverage to negotiate a peace treaty and an alliance. And then Federation doesn't do any better. Vance is like, I can't believe I'm saying this, but this is a good idea. Let's do it. Of course, you know, we're going to have to strip you all of your power and then put you up for war crimes just so everyone knows this is legit. And she's like, no, fuck that plan. I'm going back to plan B, which is murdering all of you.
She's like, yeah, that was kind of like going for the nuclear option, don't you think? Did you really think that was going to work out well?
I mean, she wanted the spore drive anyway, but all of that trouble just to break into Starfleet headquarters and then say, here, I'm going to negotiate, you know, an alliance. Or like, I know it's 1,000 years in the future, but certainly people still send emails.
Space emails.
Go on to the Federation's Facebook page and go, hey, I've got an interesting proposition. Facebook. DM me for details.
Doggett, you seem to have passed out. Are you okay?
Oh, so what I was going to say was I was talking about the science officer with the short hair. I really liked her character. She was actually really funny. But also, I actually enjoyed Saru's journey. In the second season, he went through an evolution, like literally, that kind of changed up his character a lot. In this season, it's him coming to terms with the fact that he's way more like Burnham than he would ever think so. Especially with how the show ends. This season specifically. That was one of the more interesting parts of the season.
Despite the fact that it makes sense the way that Saru ends his arc on here, I kind of hate the fact it really does appear they're writing him off the show. And every time the showrunners have been asked about it, they have declined to answer. So I'm thinking that's exactly what they're doing.
Man, you know that makeup expensive?
Well, no, it might be just like, he's like, okay, enough already. Right? Like, you can write me off. But Doug Jones' whole career, like, how many roles has he even played when he wasn't under pounds of latex, you know?
This is the best role he's had in years, though. He's always played monsters, but this actually lets him be a character over several seasons. This is the best acting I've seen him do in forever.
But what really bugged me about the way they ended Saru is they already did this story earlier in this season with Commander Nahn, played by Rachel Antero, who leaves the show to help a member of her race, the Barzan. It's the exact same thing. And I was like, come on, that's fucking lazy.
Yeah.
But that's the problem with this show. It's got so many characters, and no disrespect to the actors, I think they're really good. But so few of them have anything to do.
100%.
That, you know, I still don't know all of their names.
Exactly.
I'm still like, okay, there's Black Lady with dreads. There's Cybernetic Lady with the weird shit in her face. Genial Asian guy.
In the second season, I thought they killed the Asian guy.
And they did this with the Cyborg Lady in season two. It's like, hey, you've been here for 2 seasons and we've never given you more than a couple lines. Now we're going to build an episode around you just so that we can send you off.
Yeah, George Takei's like, cry me a river, lady.
The perfect embodiment of the very issue of too many characters in the finale when the life support is out on the lower decks and they have to get to the nacelles to blow it up, right? And there's the one character who just drops the freaking exposition that she can hold her breath for 10 minutes. And there's 5-6 other characters in that hallway with her, all completely superfluous. It could just have been Tilly and her trying to get there and being like, just, you got to go on without me. The oxygen's out. The rest of the bridge crew, whose names don't matter, didn't have any reason to be there. And I still think Michael Burnham is the least interesting character because she's 3 characters. So she has to be involved in all the plots. But if you could take her interacting with the relationships over here and her dealing with command over here, you could split some of that up piecemeal and give it to the other characters to give them agency, right?
Disagree.
It would be like giving Picard Riker's stuff as well.
The Next Generation, there were all the time episodes that didn't even feature Picard or Riker in them.
Yeah.
You were like, yeah, it had nothing to do with them. This is about these other characters.
There's 7 characters here and they all matter.
Here it's the Michael Burnham show.
When this season started, I was like, when she's tripping balls and she's hanging out with Book, I'm like, they finally figured out what to do with this character. Then they jump a year later. I'm like, okay, she's had a year to evolve off screen. And then she just falls right back into her, I'm going to defy the rules and play things my way. And like typical Star Trek, she's rewarded for her bad behavior.
You got to let this shit go. Star Trek was a long time ago, guys. Come on, let it be something different. Let it change.
It's not a matter of making it different. It's a matter of structure.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think we're saying at all. Yeah. I love a lot of the things that are super different about this show.
I want her to be a more engaging character rather than hitting the same beat of, Michael Burnham, you disobeyed a direct order, but God damn it, it worked. They do it every episode.
But it's always different. Like, maybe she makes the same decision, but she's making the same decision the same way Captain America always makes the same decision when encountering a new government. Like, the first season's government is different than the second season's government. The third season's government is different than the first second season's government. Maybe she is doing the same beats, but in many ways, as she's evolving, there are still core elements to her character that remain the same. Which is why she will always be on these missions, because she wants that action. She wants to discover new places. And finally, after three seasons, I can finally experience what a Star Trek live-action show is going to be like in the fourth season, hopefully.
It's a matter of consistency. I'm looking at this strictly from structure. I write for a living, so I'm constantly analyzing character. Why she doesn't work is because she's so inconsistent. She can say, I don't want to be involved in personal lives, and then involve herself in everybody's personal life because she's the main character. Saru's arc through this season was fantastic. He embodies Roddenberry's vision of Starfleet captain. He's diplomatic. He's empathetic. He learns. He questions himself and those around him, and leads spectacularly and performed wonderfully by Doug Jones. The reverse of that, Michelle Yeoh is fantastic as an anti-hero. She has grown so much since we've met her. I both liked and disliked her two episodes.
Like, anytime you're going to bring back the Guardian of Forever, I'm just like,
what is that?
Is this happening right now? I'm like,
the original series episode that was a big talking hollow geode, and now it's Carl.
It's Carl. He's Q, right? Come on.
I guess he's a Q.
He's a
right?
Q. The dude in the bowler hat drinking tea nerds on the winter planet.
You're on a Star Trek review. You do not get to call anyone a nerd.
Right. You agree to watch all the episodes.
I thought it worked better than it didn't. I mean, everybody loves the Mirror Universe. Yeah. The one really odd thing that came out of all this, though, is so we knew that they were going to get rid of Michelle Yeoh somehow, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Because she had already been cast on the show Section 31, right, the Star Trek spinoff that takes place back in the previous show's timeline. So somehow she's got to go back. However, if you listen to what the Guardian actually says, he says she is sent back to a time before the Mirror Universe diverged from the primary universe. And everything, and I had to do my research on this one, so sorry, I am a nerd, dog it, you're right. Everything that they've told us so far suggests it's sometime around the 16th or 17th century.
Oh.
Ha-ha!
Fascinating.
So that could be fun.
Daggett, you can just tune out for a moment. The only divergence I ever knew that was in the story was in The Return, the Shatnerverse, where it came down to a coin flip by Zefram Cochrane to decide if he should tell the Vulcans about the Borgs or not.
Some people have like suggested that that was the moment, yeah, but apparently there are hints here and there throughout it that say, no, it was much earlier.
Interesting. Okay, cool.
Because they've quoted authors who were not the authors of stuff from like literature in a much earlier period. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, well, that was a divergent thing then.
Gotcha.
So I'm just going to bring up some stuff to lightning round us through the rest of this review. Book killing Zara after she insults his cat Grudge. Hooray! Yeah. She's a queen! I was like, that's right, bitch. You don't insult a man's cat. I don't want to hear it, Doggett. I know what you're going to say. I don't want to hear it.
Catch me, Eden.
Also, like I said, it really bugged me. They were like, wait, he can operate the spore drive? Yeah, how? You know, he feels stuff.
A tardigrade could operate it. In theory, anyone could. That thing's got a brain the size of, you know, an atom.
But they've been very specific before that not everyone could. And it felt very mechanical. Like, well, shit, we wrote ourselves in a corner. How are we going to fix this? That's what right. It felt.
It's like Air Bud. The rules don't say he can't.
Nice. Other question. Who is the Federation president? They never actually say. People kept thinking, oh, it's the guy Oded Fehr from the Mummy movies. He's an admiral, Admiral Charles Vance, but he is not the Federation president. Some people were suggesting, well, maybe it's David Cronenberg who keeps appearing for some reason in here, who's clearly a higher up in the Federation, Kovich.
He's Section 31.
They never say his rank or anything, but I wonder, they reference specifically in here that we have very strict temporal laws now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think this is the beginning of yet another spinoff of saying, okay, there's a temporal wars force.
No. I'm convinced Section 31 is going to be about these temporal wars. I think that's their hook. Hmm. And I think it's going to be the Michelle Yeoh and maybe even David Cronenberg. And for fuck's sakes, can we talk about the fact that David Cronenberg is in a Star Wars? I mean, Star Trek? Sorry.
You messed it up.
No, I didn't mess it up because I conflated two ideas simultaneously because that's how fucking smart I am. I was actually thinking of the guys doing this show saw The Mandalorian and said, they got Werner Herzog? Can we do something like that? What other kind of weird iconoclastic director is available, lives in Toronto, and is relatively affordable? Holy fuck, David Cronenberg. And he shows up, you gotta figure, he's like, I'm not gonna wear any weird space shit. Just give me a suit, I'm gonna wear my glasses. That's it. David Cronenberg is the only guy in Star Trek, it seems, with glasses.
He said they make him look smarter. She asked him point blank, why are you wearing glasses?
The old guy with glasses was Michelle Yeoh?
It's David Cronenberg.
Oh shit, I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
When is Tyler Perry going to come back to Star Trek?
The lightning round. Continue the lightning round.
Tilly being made acting captain is fucking weird. And I went, nope, sorry.
Yeah, I'm with you.
She's an ensign.
No good.
Like, yeah, everybody likes Tilly. She's not even faintly qualified of all those people on
Thank
the bridge
you.
To be the one you'd pick
Thank
to
you.
Sit in the chair. I was like, that is dumb. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I like Tilly too, but come on. Ending with Michael Burnham being captain, okay, well, I guess, but I kind of, one of the things I liked about the show was that she wasn't captain and didn't particularly want to be. Also, the new uniforms suck.
Yes.
I much prefer the blue.
Guest appearance by the wonderful genre staple actor Christopher Heyerdahl as the leader Wen of the exiles from Saturn's moon Titan in the Earth is Fucked Up episode, which I always like, he's just wearing a helmet and like a disguised voice the whole time, then taking off, it's like, hey, it's Christopher Heyerdahl! He's in every science fiction show for it. At least one episode. So what was up with that digital gel stuff that Michael was pushed into during the big end fight that she had with Osira? I mean, were we supposed to know what that was? I mean, she was like Homer sinking into the, like, the shrubbery.
I thought she was merging with the smart matter or whatever.
I thought Sigourney Weaver was going to show up and be like, why is that here? What is the point of this?
I mean, really, I just think smart matter is like that thing you would get at, like, Hot Topic. Remember the push pins that you could put your face in and it would just leave an impression? That's what it would do. It would just, like, lean back. It wouldn't, like, absorb into you or something. That's just weird.
This is just a matter of personal frustration. They never give you a close-up look at any of the Federation ships. They're always way off at a distance. USS Voyager is the fucking flagship of the fleet. We don't even
never
get to see it.
Yeah.
I did like that one of the ships is Eisenberg class, which was a nod of the hat, a tribute to the late actor Aaron Eisenberg, who played Nog on DS9, which was kind of cool. No mention at all of an Enterprise existing, which I assume is going to come into the story at some point.
There was a ship called the Yelchin, which was a nod to Anton Yelchin.
I didn't catch that. Yep. That's beautiful.
So there's a new race that have come up called the Zahians, which are obviously going to be a thing for Star Trek. They just haven't really given them a big thing yet. The first appeared in the Short Treks episode Runaway, the first episode with Queen Poe, as that race is introduced. And then there was one in Picard. And now Adira appears as one in the Hollow environment in the final episodes.
Yeah,
and we're
like,
okay, clearly you're trying to make us familiar with this race. So I would expect to see the Zahians pop up more in the next season. The Sphere data, which has just been kind of in the background, like literally holding that ace in your deck for when it's time to play it. Mm-hmm. Well, they finally play it. And this is something even I didn't catch. Another Short Treks episode, Calypso, the only one that wasn't dated, that doesn't tell you when it is, took place during apparently a 1,000-year period that we don't know when it is. The Discovery was unmanned and adrift in space, except for the AI, which was voiced by Annabelle Wallace, who is not the voice of the AI on the ship, until she is at the very end of the last episode when the Sphere data is merged with the ship's computer.
Wow.
So that sets up a something in the future where the ship is going to be empty and floating in space for 1,000 years, plus a more intelligent and self-aware ship's computer.
And now Star Trek has astromechs, and I'm cool with
it. I am cool with that.
Those .23, they're astromechs. You know, that's the Star Trek equivalent, and I'm here for it.
Mm-hmm.
We know about the Vulcans. We know what happened to the Romulans. We know what happened to the Orions, Andorians, Bajorans, and Cardassians. But once again, nothing about the Klingons, which I found immensely frustrating, and nothing about the Borg either. Talk about holding a card into the deck. I would love it if they find the Borg to turn out there now like the nicest, most helpful race in the whole galaxy.
Resistance is optional. Come on in.
They're Canadian, basically.
Oh, hater. Yeah, you want to come up on in here? That's fine. It's up to you.
I just envision the Moor as like they've started Space IKEA. They just sell modular furniture. Everything's uniform. Everything connects. They have great little meatballs. They don't pressure you, but they're like, look, don't you want to be like everyone else and have the exact same stuff?
Their chocolate is amazing.
Chocolate. I still have extra pieces though. I'm like, oh no, I'm good.
You just need a new arm, and hold on, let me get you the Armvert model, and we'll just slap it on there. Oh Christ, I can't find that little Allen wrench we need to put it on. Yeah, they're just modular people now.
And they've come so far that they are willing to call it an iPhone.
Nice.
Thank you. I'll be here all night, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
They called it a Wii phone originally, but yeah. All right, let's go to final thoughts. Dog it.
If you want a show with amazing characters, some extremely emotional moments, lingering questions about whether or not what they did was right or wrong, and you're left dwelling to the moral dilemma of it all, you should really go watch The Orville.
I knew that's the joke you were going with.
But season 3 of Discovery? That is nothing to joke about. That's a major improvement compared to season 1. Season 1 was half of a good show. Season 2 was a whole good show. And this season is also a whole good show. I don't really have much else to say about it. You guys have kind of gone in depth about every last crook and nanny. 7 out of 10... times people get launched to space.
TC?
I will say that Star Trek Discovery has given me a lot of what I want, though there are still plenty of things here that I don't particularly care for. Like most Star Treks, season 3, it starts to figure itself out, which seems to be the tradition of all the shows. And maybe we'll get 7 seasons out of this, and we'll remember the dark times of 1 and 2 and how the show turned around in season 3. Most of the best parts of what makes Star Trek great for me are here. The characters, the moral conflict, the exploration of and the questioning of what makes us human, the fun adventure through the stars, the conflict of cultures doing everything they can to find their way to work together, the diplomacy, and the shoot first, ask questions later. It's all here. But there's a lot of the Abrams modern Trek in here and also parts of modern serialized television that I don't love. There are too many characters. There's an unnecessary abundance of quips sometimes. Impossible should never be in the lexicon of a Starfleet officer. The violent action at the expense of nuance and yet not giving tongue kissing when they finally give a kiss on the show. What's that all about? And the underdeveloped plot points. But at the end of the day, what this gets right, it gets it right really well. And it's learned its lesson from everything that's come before in Star Trek, including its first 2 seasons. And it's crafted a fun, exciting, and sometimes meaningful show that is very Star Trek. So if you've made it to season 3, you're in for the long haul. If you haven't checked the show out yet, and you're even a little bit interested, I say go for it now, because this could be it. This could be a finite show. They could end it right here. I hope they don't.
It felt like this was it. I mean, it ended the way like the last TOS Star Trek movie did, with like almost like the signatures going off into space.
Seasons 4 and 5 have been greenlit.
They have.
Yeah. But I could see them saying we're done at 5.
It ends the ship going at warp speed and Michael going bang.
Bang. Well, if they can continue to trim the fat and perfect what they have here, I'm in for it. I give 3 burning insults from Michelle Yao out of 5.
Marco?
This is a kind of a frustrating experience because I rate every season pretty much the same. This season was a huge leap forward, and yet they do enough dumb things that it kind of drags it back down to what I would have rated the others. I've always had fun with it. But it's one of those things where as soon as the episode's over and I start thinking about it, I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That makes fucking sense. They could have done this. As I said earlier, there's a lot of things that I would have much rather they explored rather than just wrapping it up with a bow and moving on to the next story. Because if you're going to tell these kind of stories, you're going to have these kind of beats and characters and themes that are going to sustain over multiple seasons. Mm-hmm. Trying to forge a new alliance in the future with an organization that is basically the evil flip side of the Federation, that's fascinating. Dealing with a universe without dilithium. That's interesting. Season 3 introduces those concepts and then just wraps them up at the end in the final episode. And I was a little bummed out by that. character's great. Sonequa Martin-Green, she's a fantastic actor. She hits every beat. Even when I don't agree with what the script's giving her to do, she always makes me care about Michael. Even the cast, when they don't have much compelling assigned to them, they're still always likable. Mm-hmm. And I want to see more Saru.
Doug Jones, yeah.
I have to give this 7 out of 10 planets made out of dilithium that are just conveniently located for the purposes of the plot.
Kind of ridiculous, right? It's so the original series, like plot stuff, that I kind of was like, okay, right. That's something TOS would have done. And I kind of like that as well. This whole season feels like on some level it was trying to claim bits and pieces off of all the shows, yeah, and the feelings of those shows and forge something new. And it doesn't always work. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way that showrunner Alex Kurtzman always shoots himself in the foot on stuff that he's done. A lot of the Deus Ex Machina shit of plot machinations that are just obviously written to get yourself out of a corner in a lazy way. Too many characters. It doesn't always work, but when it does work, it's really, really good. I do like all these characters on the whole. I do kind of wish they would have, as Marco said, the arcs that are like not just a season arc, but are like, this is the arc for the fucking show. Like, it's going to go in and out of this, and it'll let everyone breathe and give us a chance to explore these other side characters deeper, more Planet of the Week episodes. I love Planet of the Week episodes. Star Trek Next Generation, everyone loves the most when they're like the best of both worlds two-parter. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. But we also love The Inner Light, which was this totally standalone little
thing.
Hell yes. And this is a show comprised entirely of best of both worlds episodes. And you know what? We need a little bit more of The Inner Light in here to make this truly work. Figuratively speaking, I think overall this is pretty solid. I definitely have problems with it, but hey, it's the third season. I think it's the best one yet. I actually thought 2 was pretty solid overall. 1 was uneven as fuck, but still was fun to watch. I love the new addition of Book and Adira. I think they're great. And apparently, formerly evil dude in wheelchair is now a member of the crew. I love how they're just like, oh, are you not evil anymore? Come on, you can join us.
You can work in engineering.
I'm going to give this 7 out of 10 Michael Burnham tears, which I guess should be more like 70 out of 100.